From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we'll hear from the ACLU about changes they want to the Michigan Sex Offender Registry, which restricts ex-offenders.
And it makes it a crime to do things like go to your child's graduation or school play or sports event.
A legal expert helps us understand what is and what is not a conflict of interest using Michigan Supreme Court political campaigns as an example.
Who is finding it so important to decide who sits on the Michigan Supreme Court that they're willing to spend millions of dollars?
The opioid crisis is hitting tribes in Michigan hard.
The use of opioids among Native American high school students has doubled the national average.
And the Ann Arbor Blues Fest begins a year-long celebration of its 50-year anniversary with a photo exhibit at the Ann Arbor Art Fair, plus a chat with the Michigan Radio political cartoonist. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we explore the impact of the opioid crisis on Michigan's tribal communities.
One of our court employees lost two daughters in the last year and a half. That certainly has rippled not only through the community, but also through the court itself. That's a lot of trauma just for that one family. But there are others. There are other stories.
Then, in 2016, a federal appeals court ordered Michigan to make changes to its sex offender laws. After little movement, a recent lawsuit filed by the ACLU seeks to force the state to make those changes. That's later in the hour. First, the voters, not politicians proposal is on the ballot this fall. It would establish an independent commission to draw the legislative and congressional district boundaries instead of allowing the party in power to draw them. The proposal is to put an end to gerrymandering. The party in power now, the Republicans, want it off the ballot. A group called Citizens Protecting Michigan's Constitution filed a lawsuit to challenge that ballot effort, saying it's not just a constitutional amendment, it's an overhaul of the Constitution. The Court of Appeals rejected the challenge, and now it's going to the state Supreme Court. That Citizens Protecting Michigan's Constitution group is closely aligned with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. The Michigan Chamber of Commerce also hosted fundraisers for two of the Michigan Supreme Court justices up for election. Chris Wilder and Elizabeth Clement, both appointed to the court by Republican governors, both expected to be nominated by the Republican Party. Joining me now is Douglas Keith. He's a counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, working primarily in the Democracy Program. So should those two justices, whose campaigns are partially funded by the chamber, vote on the ballot proposal that the chamber-supported PAC is fighting?
So the rules for when judges have to step aside from hearing a case differ by state. As with other states, some rules in Michigan are clear. A judge can't hear a case if his or her spouse is a lawyer on the case. Or if they have a financial stake in it. But this case falls into the murkier bucket of cases where you ask the question, is there an appearance of bias or impropriety? Judges aren't generally the best judges of what amount of possible bias will affect their decisions. And so the more important question is, what will the public think? And again, the judges are not always the best at assessing what the public thinks is okay and what it thinks is not. For example, we polled a while back and found that 90% of people think judges shouldn't be hearing cases involving major campaign donors, and yet most states, including Michigan, don't have rules that expressly prohibit judges from hearing those cases.
Right. I wanted to actually talk about that just a little bit, because most of the Supreme Court justices and former justices that I've talked to tell me they hate having to raise money at all, and that most of the TV ads are out of their control. Outside money tries to influence the Supreme Court elections, and the justices feel like they're not even in control of their own campaigns. So do they get a pass when they just go to a fundraiser that the chamber happens to host?
Again, it's going to be up to the judges, and if one of the parties decided to press the issue, in Michigan, the process for deciding whether a judge should step aside is actually pretty good compared to most states. So the full court would decide, not just the individual judge, whether it was appropriate for that judge to hear the case. And you're going to have to look at, since the rules are not set in stone, each individual circumstance to decide whether or not the public is going to be okay with that judge sitting on the case. An individual contribution, for example, may not raise that many issues if it was a small amount. But you start raising serious questions when judges are attending fundraisers of organizations, or these organizations are sponsoring fundraisers for those individual justices. I think it's these are serious questions of whether the public will take these opinions seriously when they come down.
I wonder if it even matters, though, because the appearance of impropriety is disturbing, but because of all the dark money going into these Supreme Court justice races, there might be all kinds of conflicts of interests in which they still vote, and we might never know. What can we do about that?
Absolutely. Disclosure is an enormous issue in judicial elections. There's this difficulty where you'll sometimes hear folks say that, well, disclosure is just going to alert the judges and justices to the folks that are spending on their campaigns. But I think the reality is more that they know. And it's important that the public know who is spending on these campaigns, who is finding it so important to decide who sits on the Michigan Supreme Court that they're willing to spend millions of dollars on campaign ads to influence those races, often on ads that talk about issues that aren't really the issues that the spenders care about. They're just issues that they know will get voters' attention. And so reforms like disclosure of all campaign spending, whether or not it's directly to the justices or independent, reforms around what cases justices can hear when they've gotten support, whether it's direct or whether it's this independent spending, are critical to making sure that the public's confident the court is playing the role it should.
You know, it's ironic that millions of dollars are being contributed to these justice campaigns, these campaigns for Supreme Court justice, because a good chunk of the electorate never even makes it that far down on the ballot, since there's not an R or a D by their name. Is that typical in most states?
Yes, I think it is important that these are low information races. A lot of us just aren't paying that close attention to them. And what we've seen is both in court races and in some other down ballot races, is that these dark money groups they're pretty sophisticated political spenders, and so they know that they can influence these races at a much lower price tag than they could influence, let's say, a U.S. Senate race or a U.S. congressional race. And so it seems to be a big draw for these groups. I think they recognize they can get a big bang for their buck.
You said Michigan laws are better than some. What's the best practices out there in dealing with elected Supreme Court justices?
So in terms of whether or not they should decide cases, elected Supreme Courts should all have rules that explicitly say that judges should not be hearing cases from campaign contributors. And those rules should include both contributions that come directly to them and these cases where you have an outside group that is spending significant sums independently of the campaign, but clearly to benefit one candidate or another. And then in terms of deciding who gets to decide whether the judge should sit in those tough cases, it needs to be independent. The judge who's being questioned shouldn't be the only one making the decision, and the court should have to publish its opinions regarding whether or not that judge should sit. And in Michigan, thankfully, that is a rule that was adopted quite recently, and that's better than most states.
It sounds like some of the safeguards are in place. It's just a little disturbing when we see money going to and from when it's so close to this case being heard. I mean, that would raise anybody's eyebrow, I think.
I think that's right. And again, unfortunately, as I said, these stricter rules are what's needed, but they are not what's in place at the moment. So it is up to the judges and the court as a whole. If anyone did decide to press for the judges to step aside, it's up to them to decide whether this creates an appearance of bias in the public's eye. To lots of folks, that's a no-brainer, but the court may not see it the same way.
If you were one of these justices, what would you do when the case challenging the anti-gerrymandering proposal came before you?
It is difficult for me to say. I'm not sure that I have all the facts in front of me, but I think what I would certainly do is not think about my own capability of deciding the case. I have plenty confidence in myself to be able to decide what will and won't bias me and put those things aside. But what's more important is what the public thinks. This is going to be a critical case this year in Michigan. It is inherently politically charged, and the public needs to have confidence that those were not considerations that went into the decision.
Douglas Keith is counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
By the way, yesterday was the deadline for voters, not politicians, to ask the justices to recuse themselves, and that group did not ask them to do so. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Michigan Radio, a radio station, has a cartoonist. His name's John Ochter, and I was looking at his cartoon today online at michiganradio.org, and basically it came down to the way you win an argument today, whoever says you're stupid first wins. So we wanted to call John Ochter up and see what motivated that or prompted that. Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
What's behind this cartoon?
Oh, just the modern way that anything seems to be discussed, particularly online these days.
Yeah, civility goes out the window really quick online. I guess you're probably seeing that just like I am.
Yeah. You know, it's not as if, especially with the editorial cartoons, there's always been, you know, immediate tripwire that, you know, there's a name or there's a word that used and immediately people go to their particular thoughts about it and really don't think so much about the issue as much about what side they represent for that issue.
Yeah, what kind of issues do you think prompt this kind of a response mostly?
The one that I was looking at was the story itself that started this was about guns. It was both a story about the state rangers had requested, I guess they had their union request that they be able to carry arms on their job because of what they perceived as an uptick in crime that they were encountering. But on the flip side of that, then, I had also just completed reading an article in Time magazine about an effort that was made to bring a lot of people with disparate views on the subject together to actually try to generate a conversation. It was interesting because it was successful in that they were able to do that. It was unsuccessful in that it didn't change anybody's minds. And in fact, some people had to be asked to leave the group because they couldn't get past, you know, the axe that they wanted to grind.
Well, I'm glad we were able to keep this conversation civil. Hey, thanks for the work, you too, John.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, the first Electric Blues Festival in Ann Arbor starts celebrating its 50th anniversary. And then how the opioid crisis is taking a toll on tribal communities. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This summer begins a year-long celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Ann Arbor Blues Fest, and it actually starts with a photo exhibit at the Ann Arbor Art Fair next week. Joining me now is James Partridge. He's the executive producer of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. So a photo exhibit, I mean, who are we going to see? What are we going to see?
Well, you're going to see a collection of images that we curated from some of the photographers who were present at the original Ann Arbor Blues Festivals from 1969 and 1970.
So that's nearly 50 years old. I guess that's the whole point of the 50th anniversary. Who are we going to see in these photos?
You'll see pictures of B.B. King, Charlie Musselwhite, Freddie King, some of the original organizers of the festival. You'll see people who were backstage, Mississippi Fred McDowell, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, basically everybody and anybody who was at the festival.
Hall of Fame folks, yeah.
Absolutely.
So who took these photos?
Some of the greatest photographers in music photography were at the festival. Baron Wolman, who was Rolling Stone magazine's first photographer and is a world-famous music photographer. We have a lot of his images in there. We also have images from Tom Coppy, who at the time was a Michigan Daily photographer and following his graduation from the University of Michigan, also went on to become a world-renowned concert photographer.
You know, when you look at some of these pictures that I've seen online, they're very interesting, but you had a whole bunch of photos to choose from. Some of them are performers on stage. Some of them are from the perspective of the stage. Some of them are private moments. How do you go about selecting them for an exhibit like this?
Well, this was actually a really difficult task, as you can imagine. One of the things that we were actually really fortunate about is the photographers were extraordinarily gracious. When we approached them and told them what we were looking to do, they opened up their entire archives for us. So all of the images that they shot at these festivals, they granted us access to. They gave us thousands and thousands of their photos. So we went through contact sheets and negatives. And what we were really trying to do when we were looking through these was to get a nice cross-section of what happened at the original festivals. I mean, obviously, you're going to see some incredible close-up photographs of the musicians themselves. But we also wanted to capture some of the intimate moments and the things that were happening backstage, things that people might not ordinarily see of the goings-on at a concert at a music festival. So you'll see some interactions between Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf that is fairly unusual. These two gentlemen are widely considered to have been competitors. You don't often see them hanging out, but we've got this amazing image. It's iconic, really, of the two of them laughing and joking around, sharing a beer backstage, which is really cool.
So photographers follow these folks around all the time. What makes this collection significant?
Well, this collection is significant, first of all, because it's from the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, and the Ann Arbor Blues Festival is the world's first electric blues festival. So, being the fact that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that, it's certainly significant. I think it's significant for the fact that it shows some of the most amazing musicians gathered in one place. That was unusual at the time. It's also significant because we gathered some photographs that are that are unusual from the perspectives from which they were shot. We've got some, like I said, we've got some really intimate photos. We've got some backstage photos. We have some photos of the crowd. We took some images of ordinary people in the crowd, for example. Some people we don't even know who they are. We put out a thing on Facebook because there's a woman in one of these photos who's talking to Mississippi Fred McDowell. She might have been a co-ed at U of M at the time. And we think she might still be somewhere here in the Ann Arbor area. And we would love to know who she is and present her with this photo and get her reminiscence about what was going on there.
Now, you have these thousands of photos too, but you're actually doing a call out for more photos. What are you going to do with all of these?
Well, we've got a couple of ideas. Immediately after the art fair, we're going to distribute the images to different places around Ann Arbor, Washtenaw County, because we'd like everybody to get a chance to see them, even if they can't make it to the art fair. So that's number one. But it's really our hope that these images find their way into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the permanent collection, or maybe the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle. Or barring that, another option that we've been exploring is establishing a museum right here in Ann Arbor on blues or music history. This is a significant town. A lot has happened here, and we think it's deserving of such a place.
I was looking at the lineup of this year's Ann Arbor Blues Fest. Online it read, in 1969, the blues threw a party and everybody came. This summer we're doing it again. Who's appearing this year?
Well, we've got some phenomenal performers this year. Shamika Copeland, Anna Popovic, Benny Turner, Bob Margolin, Janova Magnus, Carolyn Wonderland, John Sinclair and the Blues Scholars, and Don Was is coming. You know, the really cool thing is that so many of these performers have connections to Michigan and to the Ann Arbor area. And that is I think, really important. A lot of them may have become famous for their connections to other cities, but their roots are here in Michigan.
The Ann Arbor Blues Fest happens on August 17th and 18th at the Washtenaw Farm Council Fairgrounds. That's on Ann Arbor Saline Road at Pleasant Lake Road. And before that, at next week's Ann Arbor Art Fair, the Blues Fest will exhibit some historic photos we've been talking about as part of their year-long celebration of the 50th anniversary. Do you know where your art fair booth is going to be located?
Yes. We are going to be on Liberty and State Street in booth 302. 2, right across the street from the MDEN.
Great. Our guest has been James Partridge. He's the executive producer of the Ann Arbor Blues Fest. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The opioid crisis is taking a great toll on many families. More than 64,000 Americans died from drug overdoses in 2016, including illicit drugs and prescription opioids. That's nearly doubled in a decade, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Among Native Americans, the rate of opioid overdoses is disproportionately higher than that. And the rate of Michigan opioid deaths is about twice as high as American Indians, among American Indians as among other demographics. Here to talk about the impact of the opioid crisis is having on tribal communities in Michigan is Judge Patrick Shannon. He's the chief judge for the Saginaw Chippewa Tribal Court. And Joseph Somwick, who coordinates the Healing to Wellness program for the tribal court. Judge Shannon, let's start with you. Why is the opioid epidemic hitting Native peoples at a higher rate?
Well, I think there could be a number of different answers to that, but I think it's hitting all populations. But it appears, based upon information that we've received from Minnesota that has a really good surveillance, public health surveillance system, that it is affecting the Native communities at a greater rate than in the non-Native. And Michigan, unfortunately, we don't have that kind of surveillance information, so it's mostly anecdotal. But when we first got into the treatment court or Healing to Wellness Court program at Saginaw Chippewa, we recognized that our responsibility is to try to take care of things at the local level. Just seeing in the community itself the effect of opioid and prescription drug effects on overdose deaths and overdose and the effects on families is probably the same as it is in other communities, but I think you can look at the Minnesota Information Department, Public Health Minnesota, to identify the problem. And it probably goes back as to historic trauma and other issues that have faced the communities across the country, Native communities.
So give me an example, a real-life example of an individual or a family and the impact of opioids on that family or a community.
One of our court employees lost 2 daughters in the last year and a half. That certainly has rippled not only through the community, but also through the court itself. That's a lot of trauma just for that one family. But there are others. There are other stories.
The opioid epidemic is costing communities too, particularly when it comes to first responders such as emergency medical teams and police. What kind of costs is your tribe experiencing because of this opioid crisis?
Joseph here. When we look at the Saginaw Chippewa tribe, we're a part of the 12 federally recognized tribes located here in Michigan. With our statistics, we know nationally that Native Americans are twice as likely to become addicted to drugs as the rest of the U.S. population, over 3 times likely to die from a drug overdose. And the use of opioids among Native American high school students is double the national average. And this recent tribal opioid summit, we had over 420 people come in for that.
You had all 12 of the tribes in the state. You hosted this summit. What was the purpose of that? What was discussed?
Well, if anything, it was a regional summit that we had people come in from Minnesota, Wisconsin. We had some nationally known speakers. We also had Judge Linda Davis attend, and Judge Shannon has been working with Judge Davis, and she's part of the Family Against Narcotics chapter that has been very active in Michigan. Judge?
Yeah, the Opioid Summit was really an idea that we came upon last year at the Great Lakes Native Conference. You know, as to the Healing to Wellness, that's our treatment court. And early on, 5 years ago, when I came back to the Saginaw Chippewa tribe as the judge, I just found a different environment. I had been a prosecutor for many years, and when I left that, it was all law enforcement. But we've tried to congeal this down into 3 areas: and prevention of drug abuse and intervention, how do we get them in, and then also the treatment. And that's been our focus for the last 4 or 5 years. Very difficult. We've seen too much death. We've been very fortunate to work with a local sheriff in providing medical-assisted treatment for inmates at the county jail, not only Native but also non-Native. But the summit itself, it certainly identified what the problems are, but next year, our goal is to look more at treatment and prevention. How do we prevent this? And we recognize now that we have a horrible situation in this country, in this state. And it goes beyond just the idea of overdoses. It also is impacting the contagion of infectious diseases throughout the state of Michigan. Unfortunately, Michigan leads the nation in Hep C incidences. Our rates are higher than the state of California. And this is all related to substance abuse.
You know, this nation has a history of dealing with illegal drug use by putting people in prison. This opioid crisis has a lot of states finding other solutions. Your court has too through this Healing to Wellness program. How do you determine whether somebody's fit for that or not?
Well, one of the things that we do, Lester, is we have a Healing to Wellness team that meets every Monday, and we go over our clients. Right now, we have anywhere from 17 to 24 on a regular basis that's going through our program. And it's an 18 to 24-month felony diversion program that's done in phases: cleansing phase, action phase, building phase, and maintenance phase. But the important thing is to maintain a sober and drug-free lifestyle. There's also a community service component to it, attending 12-step recovery meetings, and also the wellness part is to embrace those teachings from our culture, our medicine wheel, the seven grandfather teachings, and those components to go ahead and to bring the tools to fight addiction.
For us who are uninitiated, give us a real quick explanation what the seven grandfather principle is.
Well, the seven grandfathers: honesty, truth, wisdom, bravery, love, respect, humility. And to be able to go ahead and to look at those seven grandfathers, one of the most important aspects is to have that humility, to know that you don't know. In dealing with opioid addiction, a lot of times people need to reach out for help. But once they go ahead and to make that first step of admitting they're powerless over drug addiction and their life's unmanageable, we can go ahead and use those seven grandfather teachings where they can embrace the truth and the honesty of where they're at. And then they can go ahead and to look at that medicine wheel teaching where you look at the physical, the mental, the emotional, the spiritual aspects of healing, and then they can find themselves in that circle. And one of the things we tried to do at the Opioid Summit is to bring more people into the circle. And that's why Family Against Narcotics is important. We need to bring more people into this healing circle.
What kind of challenges do tribal communities or even individual members of the tribe face in getting help or treatment?
Well, unfortunately, you have to really commit a felony to get involved in the court system. That's one of our goals in the next year or two, is to identify other access points in for treatment. And so essentially in any treatment court or drug court throughout the state of Michigan, including in Indian country, you have to commit a crime. Our goal now is to get the members or get community members, including Native and non-Native, comfortable with accessing points with their community public health programs, also the Families Against Narcotics, and then Hugs Not Handcuffs and some other programs that law enforcement has started. But this is a new area. How do we get people who are suffering into the programs without having first have to commit a felony? And that's what we struggle with as well. The problem is much larger than a law enforcement, and it's not a law enforcement issue anymore. It's a public health issue, and you have to look at this through a public health lens. And we've been doing that for the last few years. And so, you know, I've had to, because I'm not the sharpest tack on the wall, break this down into prevention, intervention, and treatment. And so we have to really look at it that way. And one of our ways of intervention is the court system, but it should not be the only way.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you what you think can be done beyond what the tribal court can do. You mentioned the Hugs Not Handcuffs, which is a program where someone who's got an addiction problem with opioids or anything else can come in and say, hey, I need help. Instead of getting locked up, they're taken somewhere to get more treatment or get that help. What else can be done or should be done?
Well, one of the things that we do from a cultural basis is we use that idea of the red road of well-briety. And this is a concept that comes from Colorado Springs, a teaching from the White Bison folks. And we talk about the four paths of the red road. It starts with true change must come from within, and then there must be a vision. Along with the vision, there must be a great teaching, And along with that great teaching, there must be a healing forest. And what we're trying to do, not only with healing to wellness for our clients, but also with our Tribal Opioid Summit and with the success that we had, we're already in the process of planning for the next one. We're trying to develop that healing forest. And programs like Hope Without Handcuffs and Families Against Narcotics, that all brings the healing forest. And, you know, for all the listeners out there to go ahead and know that they can be a part of this healing forest within our communities. It just takes a little compassion and a little activism to get everybody involved.
Just to expand on that too, I'm fortunate enough to be on the State Opioid Commission, and we're almost going to be ending here. And we've suggested a number of ideas to the governor. The most recently is the creation of a State Office of Drug Policy, which would be in the governor's office, whoever that governor would be, that would establish policies and coordinate all the efforts that's going on within the 83 different counties and the 12 different tribes. Right now, it's just so disjointed as to the approach, and a lot of really good things going on. Also, we submitted an educational packet to the governor, which was required, and it's going to be enhancing the Michigan model so it gets information into the schools.
We've been talking to Judge Patrick Shannon, Chief Judge of the Chippewa Tribal Court, and Joseph Somick, who is the coordinator of the court's Healing to Wellness program. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
A 2016 federal ruling ordered Michigan's sex offender registry to make some improvements, but 2 years later, not much has changed. We'll find out why. Stay with us. You're listening to Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The American Civil Liberties Union is fighting the state of Michigan because of how the state handles the Sex Offender Registry Act. Here to talk about the ACLU's concerns and the history of the Michigan Sex Offender Registry is Miriam Aukerman. She's Senior Staff Attorney for ACLU Michigan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good to be here, Lester.
Let's walk through this one step at a time. The Sex Offender Registry Act has been in place since 1994. As originally put on the books, what did it do?
Well, originally, it was a confidential, non-public law enforcement database. The idea was that individuals who'd been convicted of particular crimes, that law enforcement should know their addresses. And so it was a pretty simple statute that simply required individuals to update law enforcement when they moved so law enforcement would know what their address was. It was a very simple statute.
So did those requirements make us all safer?
The research has come in, a lot of the research is about much more recent iterations of the statute, that registries are actually quite ineffective and, in fact, counterproductive. But a lot of that is as a result of the changes to registries over time that have made them public, that have made them bloated, that have imposed very extensive restrictions that make it more difficult for people with sex offenses to reintegrate into the community and therefore make all of us less safe.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I just want to understand this 1994 law a little better. How long was an ex-offender listed on the sex offender registry and required to report to police, or did they have to report to police at that time?
They did not have to report. For most registrants, it was a 25-year requirement, and it simply required updating your address. So if you stayed in your same home, lived there permanently, law enforcement had your address, and that was simply all that was required. There wasn't a reporting requirement the way that there is today. So once you completed your period on probation or incarceration, if that was called for in a person's case, then you simply had your address given to the police, and that was really all that was required.
So in 2006, and 2011, the legislature expanded the law. What was changed?
Well, there were actually changes before that. There were changes in 1999 and 2002 and 2004. Basically, the legislature has continually added on burdens and responsibilities and restrictions. It's made a public registry, put it on the internet. But the restrictions that I think are most concerning and most burdensome are the ones that happened, as you mentioned, in 2006 2006 and 2011. So what happened in 2006 is that the legislature passed a statute that prohibits people who are on the registry from living within 1,000 feet of a school or working within 1,000 feet of a school, or the statute says loitering within 1,000 feet of a school. And what that in practice means is spending time with your children or being near a school. So what this statute does is it makes much of the state unavailable for where people can live, where they can work, and it makes it a crime to do things like go to your child's graduation or school play or sports event. And many registrants are actually parents. They committed offenses as teenagers or young adults. They're now married themselves, have children, trying to raise families. And these are really, really severe restrictions on these individuals. It's also extremely difficult for individuals to comply with these requirements because nobody knows where these zones are. So, for example, in Grand Rapids, about 50% of the city is off limits to people who are on the registry, but nobody can tell you where that is. And so people live in constant fear of not knowing, can I take my child to this park? You know, my employer has sent me to go work in this other office today. Can I actually go work there? It's an incredibly difficult statute for people to comply with. So that's what happened in 2006. And then in 2011, the law was comprehensively rewritten to create tiers of offenses, of offenders, and many, many individuals were required to register for life. So before 2011, roughly a quarter of people were on the registry for life, and after 2011, it's about three quarters. So it retroactively extended registration periods, and it required very, very extensive reporting requirements. So for example, if someone starts to borrow a car, you know, your car breaks down and you borrow someone else's car, you have to go to the police and report that. If you create an new internet address, say you're tired of using Yahoo and you want to have a Gmail account, or you want to go to NPR and comment on this news story and you need to create an account to do that. If you want to do that, you have to go report in person within 3 days to the police department and tell them that you've done that. So there are very, very extensive restrictions that were imposed in 2011.
Let's go back to that tier thing, because I'm wondering, how do you determine, first of all, how many tiers are there? And who decides and how do they decide where you land in this ranking?
So it's a three-tier system, and it's entirely offense-based, which is one of the reasons why it's so ineffective. Because what we know from the research is that the offense of conviction doesn't really correspond to risk. There are clinical assessments, there are statistical and actuarial instruments that can be used to assess risk. But the offense of conviction really has nothing, very, very little to do with it. And so whether you are on for 25 years or life, how frequently you have to report is tied entirely to your offense. It doesn't matter whether you've been offense-free for decades, which is actually, in terms of the actuarial assessment, in terms of risk, is actually very, very important. Because what happens is that the research shows very consistently that there's a higher risk of recidivism for about 3 to 5 years. And then after that, recidivism risk drops off dramatically over time, so that it actually drops lower than the baseline population. And so having these extensive, long periods of registration, it's completely pointless. And yet, what the tiers do is they simply say, you were convicted of this offense in 1995. You're going to be on the registry for the rest of your life. It doesn't matter that you're completely rehabilitated, that your risk of recidivism is actually lower than, that of a teenage college male. You're going to have to register for the rest of your life and comply with all of these onerous restrictions. And so it's completely divorced from the science and the research, and yet we subject, almost 44,000 people in this state to that regime.
There have been lawsuits filed by a handful of people who felt that they were being treated unfairly by being listed on this registry. What became of those suits?
Well, the most significant of those is a case called Doe v. Snyder. It's a case that we litigated at the ACLU along with the University of Michigan Clinical Law Program. And over 3 years ago, the district court in that case held that many of these provisions are unconstitutional, in particular that these zones that I was talking about that were added in 2006, that they're so incomprehensible, no one knows where they are. You can't ask people to follow a law that they don't understand, that they can't comply with. The court also said that this law is so complicated and criminalizes so much ordinary conduct, you know, taking your kid to the local park, that kind of thing, potentially taking your kid to going to a parent-teacher conference. The judge said these restrictions make it a crime to do things that ordinary people do. No one can understand what they are, and so they can't, certain of them can't be enforced. The state appealed that. We appealed another part of the ruling, and then almost 2 years ago, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals held that these 2006 and 2011 amendments cannot be applied retroactively because they impose punishment. They are so harsh, the judges of the Sixth Circuit said, that they're punishment. And that ruling is interesting because it's really based on the ineffectiveness of registries. The court said an unconstitutional statute and an ineffective statute are essentially the same thing. It looked at the research. It said, this doesn't work. This registry is broken, and it's so broken that there's no purpose for it, and so it's punishment. And you can't impose these 2006 and 2011 restrictions retroactively.
But the state's still doing that, though. I mean, that was 2016 that ruling came out, and not much has changed.
That's exactly right. We had thought that after the 2016 ruling, the state sought certiorari from the U.S. Supreme Court, attempted to have the Supreme Court take the case, and the Supreme Court declined to do so. So this decision is a binding precedent, and it was really an opportunity for the legislature to reform a system that people know is broken, that, you know, legislators will tell you privately they know that this registry is bloated. They know that it has way too many people on it. I mean, if you look at the number of people on the registry, there are more people on the registry than live in the cities of, you know, than live in Muskegon or than live in Port Huron or than live in Mount Pleasant. I mean, that's how bloated this is. Legislators know that. They know that this registry is counterproductive. They know that the research shows, Department of Justice studies have shown specific to Michigan, that these zones actually increase recidivism. They know that.
Why haven't they done anything? It's in their power.
It's certainly in their power, but legislators will tell you there's a political cost. I mean, this is an issue that's not widely understood. The consequences, the fact that registries make us less safe, it's not something that people really understand. And so legislators are afraid to do that. And I think, you know, what we've now done is to file a follow-up case that will expand the rulings of the Sixth Circuit and of the district court to all of the people on the registry. And I think of that as really, you know, it's a gift to the legislature. It's saying, you know, we hear you. We understand that this is a politically complicated issue for you to deal with. And so if you aren't going to take the steps that we need to make Michigan's citizens more safe, then we'll have the courts do it. And so this is a real opportunity. It's a real gift to the legislature. And it's something that is very important for the safety of Michigan families and safety of Michigan kids, because we can all agree that sexual assault, sexual offending, imposes tremendous harm. And what we need are evidence-based solutions that actually work. We want to focus on prevention. We want to focus on treatment. We want to focus on supporting survivors of these kinds of offenses. And we don't need and shouldn't have a registry that is broken, that is counterproductive, that doesn't work.
Miriam Ackerman is Senior Staff Attorney for ACLU Michigan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Lester.
Let's turn now to Senator Rick Jones. He's the chair of the Michigan Senate Judiciary Committee. There seems to be a lot of confusion about this Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling. Different counties are doing different things because of pending litigation. The state police are not talking, and they're in charge of the sex offender registry. What, if anything, do you think needs to be changed?
Well, I wrote the sex offender registry law to bring it into compliance with the federal government. That was quite some time ago when I was in the House. However, there's been some court rulings, so it needs to be updated.
What do those updates entail?
Well, there's many things. It would take a bank of attorneys to sit down and go over all the rulings and bring us in compliance. Things like if you're a parent of a child in school, but you're on the registry, that you would be allowed to go visit the school for a parent-teacher conference and that sort of thing.
How do you strike a balance between the rights of an ex-offender and the safety of nearby residents?
Well, I believe that if you are an extreme dangerous person, you need to be on there. People need to be notified where you live. They need to tell their children not to go to your home for trick-or-treating or anything else. So I think it's very valuable. But I do think that over the years, there have been some offenses that have gotten on there that probably could be removed.
Do you think that people who have not had any charges against them for, you know, in some cases, decades, should be reviewed and removed?
It depends what the original charge was. Science has shown that a child molester, an adult who molests a child, it really has a sick mind, and it's not easily cured, probably never cured. So I do think there are some very dangerous people out there that should not be removed. However, I think that some young people experimenting as they grow up, making a mistake in their teenage years could be removed.
I'm often surprised how popular the sex offender registry is among residents. Some people keep an eye on it on their town or their neighborhood on a regular basis. Are any kind of changes going to cause an uproar among voters?
Well, that's the problem I have. People have asked, why haven't you changed to bring everything in compliance with court rulings? You're the chair of judiciary. And I said, I'm a former police officer. I know a lot about sex offenders and dealing with them, and I would be happy to rewrite it. But I tried very hard last year to bring the ACLU, the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, the Michigan State Police, the Attorney General's Office. I tried to get them all together on the same page, and I just was not able to do it. Now, as realistically, as we close in on an election, very few senators or representatives are going to be willing to vote to do major changes.
Yeah, and as soon as you say sex offender in an election year, I imagine that causes a lot of problems for concerns about political futures. You, as you mentioned, were a law enforcement officer. You were a sheriff of Eaton County. You've got some experience with this. What do you understand about this that your colleagues in the legislature might not yet understand?
Well, I think that there are people out there that made a mistake when they were young. I have tried very hard to change the law and have had some success with what they call the Romeo-Juliet situation. Typically, this is a 17-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl in high school. They become lovers. The age of consent is 16 in Michigan, and so the boy gets in trouble, could be in trouble for a very long time, not being able to get employment, not get into the Army, that sort of thing. So I have tried to work with that and change the law in that area. But it's difficult because people fear the political consequences.
What's it going to take to prompt changes? Is it going to have to be through lawsuits like the ACLU has filed, or is there going to be a way you can do something legislatively?
I believe at this point nothing is going to change this year. I'm hoping that the state police, the Prosecutors Association, the ACLU, everybody comes together next year and comes up with a solution. It can be done. I thought we were close, but the problem is the ACLU believes somebody should be examined scientifically to see if they are going to be a danger to society before sentencing. And the prosecutors, attorney generals, believe it should be after sentencing, part of a parole type thing.
Yeah, that's a sticking point, it sounds like. That's Senator Rick Jones. He chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's a Republican from Grand Ledge. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Have a great day.
Here on Stateside on Monday, you heard about the corpse flower. You were listening, right? It was about to bloom for the first time at Meyer Gardens in Grand Rapids, and the staff acquired the plant, known as Putricia, 18 years ago. Well, yesterday, Putricia made her grand and malodorous arrival.
Just like any flower will give off like a scent, this flower happens to produce a combination of chemicals that give off the scent of rotting flesh.
That's Wendy Overbeck, Senior Horticultural Manager at Meyer Gardens. There's not a lot of time to go see and smell the corpse flower before it closes back up. It blooms typically 24, 48 hours. It's up to the plant when it will bloom again, but the average time is 4 to 6 years. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who put as little energy into the program as possible. Saving energy. He thinks he's being green. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Haran, Sophie Sherry, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.